It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. Great panel for you. Bill Detweiler from Tech Republic, Patrick Beja from FrenchSpin.com, and my friend Denise Howell from This Week in Law. Lots to talk about. We'll get Denise's take on the Trump executive order shutting down Twitter and the French offer for Twitter to move to France. We'll also talk about the House of Representatives. They're going to vote this week to protect your browser history, or will they? And then finally, at the end, I want you to stay tuned because we have a one-on-one conversation with my good friend Baratunde Thurston, author of How to Be Black. We'll talk about the events of the past week. It's a very important segment, and I want you to stay tuned for that. It's all coming up next on TWiT. This Week in Tech comes to you from TWiT's LastPass Studios. You're focused on security, but are your employees? LastPass can ensure they are by making access and authentication seamless. Whether they're working in the office or remotely, visit LastPass.com/TWiT to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 773, recorded Sunday, May 31st, 2020. The Duchess of Sealand. This episode of This Week in Tech is brought to you by Masterclass, online classes taught by the world's greatest minds. Get unlimited access to every Masterclass, and as a listener, you'll get 15% off the annual all-access pass. Go to masterclass.com/TWiT. And by LastPass. Prepare for the unexpected in your business with LastPass, trusted by over 17 million users and 61,000 businesses worldwide. Visit LastPass.com/TWiT to find out how they can help you. And by Worldwide Technology. You need to maintain your critical operations, and you've got to keep your employees safe while doing so. From idea to execution, WWT can keep you up and running and help you plan for the future, working with you every step of the way. Contact WWT today to request a consultation at WWT.com/TWiT2. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news with the best people available. It sounds like faint praise, but it's not. You are the best people. Bill Detweiler, editor-in-chief at Tech Republic. Great to have you back. Welcome back, Bill. Are you in Louisville?
I am still in Louisville. Yeah. It's always a pleasure to be here, Leo.
Good to have you. Also from Finland, Patrick Beja, not Patrick. Patrick is a emigre from France. You might notice his accent does not sound Finnish. Are you in Helsinki? Where in Finland are you?
No, I'm in the middle of the forest, somewhere along the coast.
It's a good place to be these days.
It's pretty good. We don't have a lot of people around, and we also got an upgrade to our fiber connection because everyone came around to work from the countryside.
Nice.
So
yeah, the connection looks great. We always get the best connections with people not in the U.S. It drives me nuts.
You know, I feel like I talk about this all the time, but when I say the middle of the forest, it's really true. The next house over is probably 2 kilometers away. And the next store is 10 kilometers away. And I have 500 down, 500 up.
Wow.
That's crazy.
Nice. I have 100 in Petaluma. That's ridiculous. Also with us, Denise Howell. Wonderful to have her back. DeniseHowell.info, former host of This Week in Law. Hi, Denise. Good to see you.
Hi. I only have 100 down and 10 up, too.
Yeah.
No fiber here.
You're in the small town called Los Angeles.
We're south of there.
A little south.
Thankfully, okay. Right now.
Beautiful Orange County. Yeah. You know, and I don't want to ignore what's going on in the United States right now. It is a terrible time, not only, you know, on top of the pandemic and more than 100,000 deaths in the U.S., which is just kind of a mind-boggling tragedy over just a few months. Now, of course, the horrific video from Minneapolis of George Floyd being murdered by a police officer, the unrest that's resulted over the last 5 nights. It's horrific. We are a tech network. So, and it's challenging to talk about tech when so many horrible non-tech things are happening, but we are going to talk about that today. But a little programming note, at the end of the show, I'll let you guys go, and about a couple hours from now, I'm going to bring an old friend in, Baratunde Thurston, the author of How to Be Black, and I want to just have a little conversation. In fact, you're welcome, all welcome to stay if you'd like, but just a little conversation with Baratunde about what's going on and what he can do to help us in the privileged class be more thoughtful so and more helpful. So that'll be at the end of the show. And I'm putting it at the end of the show partly because Baratunde has his own show right now. Actually, that's the main reason, because Baratunde has his own show right now. But also, I think it's appropriate to kind of put it at a different part of the show so that people who want to, or are trying to avoid, and I understand that as well, trying to avoid politics and the horrors of the world around us and just kind of chill, can do that as well. So I just thought I'd mention that. Although there is quite a bit of it in the tech news. In fact, I think we should probably start with the battle royale between the president of the United States and Twitter. Sorry, you want to talk about something else? What about that new iPhone? I don't know. I'm trying, folks. I'm trying. So there's an executive order that the president put out because there is a strong feeling in some conservative circles that and they've always felt this. They've always felt like Hollywood, for instance, was run by leftist liberals, Jews. They've always felt like, and I'm saying that facetiously, but I'm sorry, that's some of the undercurrent of all that. That they always felt like Silicon Valley is run. In fact, they've said it explicitly. It's run by liberals, the L word, horrible people. And it, oddly, considering that Twitter has been a bully pulpit for Trump, well, since long before he was elected, and really has been the number one place he's used to communicate to people, he feels like conservatives are censored on those platforms, chiefly his executive order focused on Facebook and Twitter and Google. And they wanted to do something about it. This happened shortly, and I don't know if it's related, suspect it is, after the president was for the first time ever fact-checked. Two tweets about mail-in ballots on Tuesday, according to protocol, the direction from on high was do something. And the something they decided to do, an executive order that was signed on Thursday with the Attorney General, William Barr, standing next to the president. I'm going to go to you, Denise, because you're the lawyer. It seems to me has no legal basis whatsoever.
Yeah, and the reaction of clamping down on Section 230 not only has no legal basis, but it doesn't really relate to what Twitter did to the president, right? What Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act does is provide limited immunity for basically online platforms of all kinds to not be sued when their users do bad things on their platforms. And there are exceptions to that.
Now, let's talk about 230, because I think it's important that we understand this. And I think it's often mm-hmm. misinterpreted. It does not declare that social networks, blogs, internet sites are common carriers. It's not giving them that kind of protection. The phone company, for instance, is not liable for what you do on the phone. Postal Service is not liable for what you write in a mail. They can't be sued. But this is different.
This is different. And it was, if you go way back in time to when it was enacted in the 90s, there was a whole lot of hand-wringing about, gee, this internet that we've created in the mid-90s that people are starting to use, is great for so many things, but it's also just a cesspool. And we're really worried about all the pornography and awful things. And it's Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. So the act itself was geared towards censoring the internet. And most of the act was thrown out as unconstitutional, except for this section, which survives. And what it does is, as you said, it does not create common carrier status, Leo. It just provides immunity, a safe harbor. So that there was a lot of hand-wringing about that whole, well, we want the internet to be a nicer place. So part of the goal of Section 230 and part of how it's been interpreted by the courts over all that time that's gone by since it was enacted is to allow websites to actually take steps to make their platforms less toxic and not to penalize them for that.
So it's not that you're penalized for what goes on your website. It's not that you're not going to be penalized for that. It's going to make it so that you don't get penalized for controlling it.
It's a little different. It's you're not penalized for all the illegal things that go on your website. Now, it's not all the illegal things. You can be held liable for some of them, like intellectual property violations or federal crimes. And recently, FOSTA carved out an exception to the Communications Decency Act provision we're talking about here, where, you know, various sex trafficking activity was supposed to be not only the responsibility of the people using the sites to spread that information, but also of the sites themselves for being the distribution platform. So that's really the distinction. Is it first party material or third party material? And in most instances, sites are immunized from what constitutes third party material. So, for example, if President Trump were to go on Twitter and defame someone, which many people would argue that he may have done at one point or another, that Twitter would not be liable for that. You would have to go after Trump. That's how 230 works.
So it is distinguished, say, from the First Amendment in the sense of protecting free speech.
Very much so. Yeah. And for anyone who's interested in a really good discussion of the interplay between Section 230 and free speech, Professor Eric Goldman is a professor at Santa Clara University, and he's, if not the foremost authority on Section 230, he's certainly way up there. And he's done a great piece on the interplay between speech and Section 230. But the easy primer to remember about speech, the First Amendment, what it prevents is government interference with speech.
Right.
So Twitter's not the government. Facebook's not the government. In limited circumstances, courts have found that, and pretty recently, actually, just last summer, Trump got slapped because he was blocking people from following his Twitter account from time to time. And the Court of Appeal, I believe it was the Second Circuit, back east, held, yeah, no, sorry. When the president is tweeting, that actually creates a public forum. And so it's government action when he blocks someone from following him.
That is censorship.
Yes.
That's a violation of the First Amendment. So it's, by the way, it's so, Section 230 has been so widely misinterpreted, misreported by even the New York Times and on every television network. It is really hard to know exactly what it does. It's worth reading it. It's only a few hundred words. It is a fundamental rule that makes the internet possible. It's two things, though. It is that first part, which says that no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by any other information contact provider. So that's that you're not responsible for stuff that's on your platform. But the part that is interesting and the part that may backfire on the president is the second part, which says in Section 230, an internet provider can restrict access to or availability of material that the provider or users consider to be obscene, lewd, lascivious, filthy, excessively violent, harassing, or otherwise objectionable without being held liable. So that's right. What lets them take the bad stuff down.
Right. And that goes back to, remember, the roots of this are we want to make the internet a nicer place, a better place.
Right.
And to the extent that any of that survived constitutional muster, that's what survived.
So it is the law of the land currently.
Yes.
No question about that. There have been many attempts to take it down. The Earn It Act, I think, is still working its way through Congress that threatens providers who don't, you know, do some things that Attorney General Barr wants to, they would lose their Section 230 exemption. But there have also been other attempts. What does this EO do? Have you read the EO? Because I can't bring myself.
It's really long and it's really difficult to read. And yes, I've read it, but I've also read, we have in the rundown today, The Verge did a nice line by line of it, analysis. And so did Professor Goldman on his blog. So for those of you who want the shorter cut to the chase version, I suggest you go to either of those places to understand what's going on here. But the upshot is
Goldman calls it better than the First Amendment.
Better than the First Amendment, as far as protecting the sites.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's I hadn't thought about it that way, but yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. So what did the EO do? I'm not sure what it will do, but what does it want to do?
It wants to punt a bunch of stuff. First of all, so bear in mind, back to your high school civics class, separation of powers, right?
Yeah.
Executive branch, judicial branch.
That's been a little muddied lately, though, I have to point out. But okay, yeah, in theory, yes.
Right. Legislative branch. So what it's trying to do is undo a law. Well, it knows it can't undo a law made by the legislative branch that's clearly constitutionally not okay. So what it's doing is it's tasking various other – so the Justice Department has been tasked with certain things. The FCC is tasked with certain things. The FTC is tasked with certain things.
By the way, there's even a question whether the president can task the FCC with anything.
Right.
He has no legal authority to do that. That's Congress's job.
Right. And in any event, even, you know, if we give him the authority to make suggestions, they don't have to – take them.
Right.
So,
although, as with many other agencies, he has the chairman of the FCC, who is somewhat of a supporter of his positions, Ajit Pai. So, it's very possible that Ajit Pai will take this as a memo that he should act on or do something about.
It's possible, but remember, there are other commissioners and they have to vote.
And they're half Democrat, half Republican. Yep.
Right.
Not that this is a partisan issue. Honestly, it's not a partisan issue. And the irony of it, as the ACLU's senior legislative counsel, Kate Rowan, pointed out, is that Trump has been all along a beneficiary of Section 230. If platforms lose their immunity, it's going to be more difficult for them to leave Trump's tweets and Facebook posts up. Now, it's interesting because Twitter has not acted about this. Is the first time Twitter has done this to the president. And they didn't even do it to something which was in some ways more scurrilous. They've now done it again because when he talked about when the looting starts, they put a warning on that and said, if you still want to read this, you have to click this warning. So they're now doing it more, but they hadn't been doing it much. And Facebook's decided not to do anything at all. So, but that's within their, that's within their current power, according to Section 230.
Right. No one has mandated that sites do.
They don't have to do anything.
Right. Except for things, you know, like.
Something else that's illegal.
Right. So is it like FOSTA, for example, that was aimed at
sex trafficking.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So there have been various, as you were pointing out, you know, people are starting to be upset that lots of bad things can happen on online platforms. And they're wondering, you know, who's responsible for that? Who should be policing that? And so Congress is starting to draw a map that looks like more and more responsibility is going to be put on the sites to, you know, eliminate fake news. We have some some further discussion on that maybe later in the show.
Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri wrote a letter to Jack Dorsey saying, if you're going to do that to the president, we're going to take away your 230 protection, which seems to be completely completely upside down.
It's upside down to me, too. I don't think the two things. Yeah, it's not the one leads to the other. It's
punishment.
Kind of a head scratcher. It's definitely retaliatory. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I don't know if there's any logical way to parse this, but I figured you're the lawyer. We'll let you try to figure out what's going on. And I think how people react to this somewhat does break down on ideological lines as much as anything else. But
And people may get confused because they'll look at something that Twitter has flagged. And as you've pointed out, Twitter tends to be pretty hands off about what happens on the platform, except for it does have guidelines and restrictions trying to reduce harassment and people having terrible issues.
I've long complained about Twitter, not because of any ideological slant. That's not apparent. Everybody gets to say whatever they want on Twitter, but just because it's a marvelous trolling platform, and the president is one of the masters of it, frankly.
And there's some irony in a conservative administration deciding that now is the time to step in and try and dictate what private enterprise is going to do and how they're going to conduct business.
Right.
That seems pretty cognitively dissonant to me, but that's really the crux of what's going on here. You know, what can our Twitter and Facebook and anybody else entitled to make decisions about how to run their platform? Well, yeah. And even if, you know, your argument is, well, okay, so you're flagging something that the president posted and saying it needs to be fact-checked. Suppose someone posted that John Adams was the first president of the United States. And would they flag that and say it needs to be fact checked? No, they don't have to. You know, they can pick and choose what they want to fact check. It's not incumbent upon them to make sure everything on their platform is true.
Patrick, from your point of view in Finland and as a Frenchman, this must all seem strange. For those listening, his head is on his hand. He's face palming. You know,
the difference we have, of course, is that we have the benefit of not having everything become a partisan issue immediately when we talk about any of this. And it's pretty obvious that it's a giant circus. But the thing that I go to when I push the thinking about all of it to its conclusion is a concern, even by, I think, most neutral standards, because, of course, this is a knee-jerk reaction by President Trump with little, it seems, legal footing. But when you go to the end, what he wants is to be able to post things on Twitter without the inaccuracies or the willful fudging of the truth be contradicted or indicated as inaccurate. And that is, to me at least, fairly concerning, because the issue isn't really about whether or not President Trump lies. I think everyone agrees, most people on the opposing side, and I think even most people on his side, I think the value to his constituency isn't necessarily the truth of his arguments. Some of it may be, but everyone knows he is a showman. And the idea that he would want his messages, his speech, to be relayed with no possibility of putting a little asterisk on, you know, next to it, saying maybe this isn't exactly true, is a little bit Orwellian to me. And I'm using, you know, the word, I'm trying to be a little bit careful. I'm not saying it's the end, you know, it's 1984. But the fact that he would want this message to not have the possibility, even though everyone agrees that there's a lot of inaccuracies, in what he says all the time, I'm being, you know, careful here, is a concern. And when I push just a little bit further, I don't even think he thinks, if he's being clever about this, he might not think that this is going to go anywhere. But what he's doing is waving a giant sword in the face of Mark Zuckerberg to warn him about doing something like this, because the election, at least in his mind, is really going to be played on Facebook as the campaign micro-targets, as it has, you know, 4 years ago. And I think that might be the ultimate goal and his fear, that if Facebook starts doing things like that, maybe it's going to affect his re-election chances, which
that's
interesting. I should note, fairly high.
Yeah, that's an interesting point of view. Actually, Zuckerberg, who apparently talks regularly with the president, in fact, even just recently, like yesterday, had a phone call with the president that both sides says were what do they call it? Mutually satisfactory, something like that, was on Fox saying, and he has a good, I got to give him credit. He has a good point. He says, we have a different policy than Twitter on this. I strongly believe Facebook shouldn't be the arbiter of truth of everything people say online. Private companies probably shouldn't be, especially these platform companies shouldn't be in the position of doing that. And I understand what he's saying. Even Twitter doesn't go through every statement on Twitter and mark it true or false. And that would be problematic if it did. True or false according to whom? And so it's interesting that they have... There are many things that the president has said on Twitter that are not true. They don't fact check each of them. They pick and choose. And I think that is, let me ask Bill about this. I feel like that's somewhat problematic as well. I think Mark's point is, how are we going to be the, why should we be the ones that decide the truth or falsehood of what's posted online?
And I think this gets to the crux of the issue as it stands now, because as you were talking about a little earlier, Leo, the reality, I think, of the internet right now doesn't necessarily match with the ideology. So in the early 90s, when 230 was enacted, you know, we wanted to be able to protect these companies to allow the internet to flourish. Everything was kind of new, and we wanted to give people a platform without being, you know, these companies without being sued to death. But now we're in a little bit different space where, you know, in order for our democracies to function, citizens and voters need quality information about what's happening in their world, about the policies that our elected officials are enacting, so that then we can make educated decisions about who we want to put into office. And so what a lot of these platforms have become is not the blogs, not the bulletin board services, not these kind of platforms for discussion, but they've actually morphed now to become news outlets. And so when you look at the percentage of people who get their what they would call news from a social media platform, it's the importance of that news being accurate becomes, you know, is greatly increased because, you know, as we saw with the 2016 election here in the U.S., as we've seen with the Brexit election in the U.K., because of the way the platforms operate, you know, it allows for influence, fake information, for opinions to be to enter echo chambers and be elevated, for people that aren't really, who are busy, who don't have the time, the effort, or the energy to sort of do their own research, or who are just looking for an outlet that promotes the beliefs that they already have. We sort of run into problems now because I think these platforms have become something that maybe they weren't, we didn't think they would be back in the 90s. And there is a double standard. So, you know, Leo, if you as a content creator, if me, you know, I at Tech Republic and part of Viacom CBS, a large media organization, if someone goes on the CBS Evening News and puts out something that's fake, we can be held accountable for that.
Right.
If we don't disclose something as advertising.
Not a platform.
We're a publisher.
Yeah.
So Facebook has said repeatedly, Twitter has said repeatedly, we're not publishers. We're just hosting this platform. And individuals that are posting material to this are actually, quote unquote, the publishers. But there's no mechanism to police that. And you are right. You know, I don't know if we want private companies, you know, gauging what is and what is not fact, gauging what is and what is not protected by the First Amendment. But I think there is a lot of frustration right now among people of a variety of political persuasions that something needs to change. Now, what that is, I don't know. Maybe it's if it's a pullback from Facebook and Twitter in the pocketbook, because I think that's really the only thing that's going to, you know, change behavior when it comes to a corporation.
It's so complicated and so difficult. I don't think that it's appropriate for Facebook or Twitter to become the arbiter of truth, because that's a lot more than they're required. On this, at the same time, I would expect Tech Republic, your publication, to try to only publish things that are true and to point people in the direction of truth. And I'm sure that's your goal, certainly our goal here at TWIT, to get to the truth. That's a big difference. But it's interesting. You know, Mike Masnick's been very good on this at Tech Dirt, and he is... said that the distinction, that publisher or platform distinction that we're having such a hard time with, is Facebook a platform? Is it a publisher? It seems to be both. He says, I'm gonna read the quote, "This publisher versus platform concept is a totally artificial distinction that has no basis in the law. News publishers, like you, Bill, are protected as well by Section 230 of the CDA. All the CDA 230 does is protect a website from being held liable for user content or moderation choices. It does not cover content created by the company itself. So you can be both. The distinction is not platform versus publisher. It's content creator or content intermediary. And so you are both at the same time, aren't you?
Yeah, we have blogs. We allow people to post to our community forums. We do our best to moderate those forums, but we are both a publisher and website, a platform protected by 230. I think the issue that we as a society, as internet consumers, as citizens have to grapple with is where we get our news from. Because I think if you ask... Yes. A lot of the average people, like, where did you see this story? Well, I saw it on Facebook. To them, Facebook is the source for that information, whether it's posted by the Washington Post, the New York Times, TWIT, Tech Republic, The Verge, CNET, or their crazy relative who lives in a cabin in the middle of nowhere, right? So I think sometimes it's a distinction without a difference, and we have to sort of live in the real world and kind of look at the reality. And I don't know what the answer is. I wish
it's very challenging.
It is a hard question to answer.
Yeah,
but that's Denise, a failure of education, though. That's a failure of education.
Well,
though.
It is. One thing, I don't want to have to place the burden on Mark Zuckerberg to tell me what's true or not. Isn't it the ideal world that both Twitter, Zuckerberg, Facebook are just platforms. They provide a place for people to publish. It's not their obligation or job to in any way editorialize upon that. It's our job as consumers of the content to do that. And if you want to, as an editorial function, Bill or me on Twit, then say, hey, you saw that thing you read on Facebook or Twitter, that's wrong. That's appropriate and a good function of the press. But why should Facebook or Twitter be, Denise, why should Facebook or Twitter be required to do that? Are they able to do it?
They're not required.
So a related legal point to bring up here is that it is so hard and so difficult for the people tasked with the role of moderating Facebook. I don't know if you remember a while ago, but when we had terrible terrorist attacks that were going forth live on Facebook and various other things, right around then is when a lawsuit ensued from the moderators who said, you know what? I mean, we are subjected to so much terrible toxic stuff that we have PTSD and various other forms of mental health issues. Yeah, exactly. Worst job in the world. Well, Facebook just recently settled for $52 million with its moderators. And, you know, so there's some acknowledgement that, yeah, they've got a bad job and that Facebook just didn't, you know, want to go forward with that lawsuit.
It's so hard, though, because you don't want if a terrorist organization is recruiting on Facebook, you want Facebook to stop that.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. You do. So, but
where do we draw the line?
I think these platforms have to pick and choose. And since we're talking about the First Amendment, that's something that's come up in this executive order and the ramifications of a retaliatory trying to scale back 230 as punishment for labeling tweets with various comments from Twitter or information from Twitter, depending on your perspective, is that private enterprises, in addition to not being responsible for protecting the First Amendment on their platform, they actually have First Amendment rights. There is such a thing as commercial speech. It's entitled to lesser protection than non-commercial speech. But if you have been paying attention over the last several days to the messages from companies like Nike, for example, or YouTube, who are putting a moment of, we are acknowledging the horrific events that happened in Minneapolis, and we're providing resources for people to learn more and contribute. And, you know, this is all commercial speech that they are engaged in, mm-hmm. as they are pointing people towards these resources. And
can they
Can they lie?
Can you lie in an ad? The FTC does have
false advertising.
Yeah, the FTC does restrict certain things, but right. not on a speech basis. You just that's misleading ad
right
stuff.
Yeah. So
I mean, we've always had restrictions on speech. I mean, in the United States, I mean, everyone loves what gets me is everyone says, "Oh, everything is protected by the First." It's not. You can't incite violence. You can't go into a crowded theater and scream fire. That's the example that my old law professors used to give us back in college. So there are restrictions on speech. You can't commit slander. You can't commit libel. So, you know, but I think that gets lost on a lot of people because, they don't know, or they don't take the time to know, or they only support the ideology of whatever the person who's saying it, whether or not they're on their team, their side, follow their philosophies.
Patrick?
I think we've made it pretty clear that this is an impossible.
Yeah. Challenging.
Right? There seems to be no clear solution. And also, as have been made very eloquently by Bill, this is a key issue that our society is faced with, and potentially we think with repercussions on the quality of our democracy, potentially. And I think that since we don't have a clear solution, it should be, and again, as legally has been pointed out by Denise, those companies have a right to police the content on their services. It's pretty clear that both approaches are valid. The approach of saying, well, it's democratically we shouldn't be policing the truth. And the approach of saying, we think we need to, in some cases, touch up on the content to indicate when it might be misleading. And the key here is that both should be allowed to exist. I think both are defensible, both are valid. And the idea that we would want to, as a society, prevent one from existing, meaning prevent companies from putting the little asterisks saying, we're not sure about this content, saying this cannot happen. All content must be required by the government, must be left untouched, is what is the most concerning. You know, right. Do we want to, I'm going to put the question back to all of you. Do we want the government to mandate that all social networks cannot touch the content that is on their platforms, all of them?
Well,
I don't think that's something.
No.
And that's the paradox of the executive order. I think what the president really would like to say is you can't touch my content.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Can you think of a human being on the planet who has a larger pulpit than the president of the United States? And you know, if you don't like a social media platform that you're using and you don't like the way that they're moderating or treating what you're attempting to get out via that platform, if you are the person with that pulpit, use your pulpit. You know, you don't have to stay on Twitter.
To take the devil's advocate point, it could be argued, I think, that Twitter and Facebook are two very special social networks that almost have status of like town square. They're unique. They're so, you know, widely used that I wonder if it could be argued philosophically, not legally, that it's impossible to not be there if you want to be heard and be present.
I think that's the case.
If you're president, it is.
Well, yeah, you know, you can command network time anytime you want. But as you pointed out, Denise, one of the points of this is to keep, or somebody, maybe Bill, one of the points of this is to keep Facebook in line so that the president's campaign can proceed unchecked. Right.
Everyone used Friendster too. You know, there are platforms all the time.
I think that once you start opinionizing on content on Twitter or Facebook, you get in this problem where nobody's going to be happy with what you say. The right's going to say, oh, you shouldn't be doing that. The left's going to say, oh, you shouldn't be doing that. It's a very difficult and narrow line to walk. I don't know how you do it effectively. You're doing it so selectively at this point, it's ridiculous.
So since that question is impossible to answer, I think the most nonpartisan way to look at it is, again, that question. Do we want the government to mandate that social networks cannot touch the content at all?
Right.
And that question is nonpartisan. It isn't. And if your answer is yes, we want all social networks to not be able to curate anything and touch anything, it is, I think, a great concern.
Nobody wants that. Everybody wants what the president wants. They want the social networks to flag stuff they disagree with and promote stuff they agree with.
And that's how Section 230 came about. There was, before it existed, there was a case that said, hey, if you're gonna claim that you have no responsibility for what's going on your platform, then you can't be involved at all. You can't moderate, you can't regulate the content there at all. You have to take a completely hands-off approach. And if you are involved in moderating, then you're complicit in what's there. Right. It was called the moderator's dilemma. And Section 230 was specifically enacted to eliminate that and make sites feel like, phew, you know, and we can get rid of some of this bad stuff and not be sued.
This battle exactly parallels the battle that's gone on for years on forums and chat rooms and between trolls and moderators. It's exactly the same conversation. It's just now that it's out of the White House instead of, you know, the troll house.
And, you know, there are a number of social networks and services that have complained about the stifling of their free speech. And they've gone and created the free speech social network and the free payment system.
Yeah.
So I wasn't going to mention them, but and you know what content's on there?
The worst content.
And we don't want that to become all of Facebook and all of Twitter. We want them to be able to, you know, curate at least a little bit.
In a nutshell, this is the paradox of our modern time. These platforms can and continue to be able to provide a great space for people to discuss the most important issues of the day, issues that we may not agree upon, but at least to bring it out in the light and have a discussion and try to come to a conclusion about it. I mean, they really offer exactly what the founding fathers wanted in a democracy. And at the same time, they can be used in the most horrific, horrible, suppressive ways as well. And it's such a paradox. And I don't think you want to stop one in favor of the other. I don't know if you even can. I don't know what the answer is. I think that's the answer. But maybe I'm just stupid. I can't think of a way to solve this, to be honest.
And Leo, then we haven't even talked about it here, but then there's the technological answer. You know, Denise brought it up earlier in talking about the people, the moderators that had to watch all this horrific content and they were traumatized by it. So you look at some of these platforms that look at algorithmic ways to filter content, because imagine how many posts are put on Facebook or put on Twitter. If you had a human actually look, there is no way to do that without hiring armies and armies of people. I mean, I don't even know if it's physically possible to do that. So you look at these algorithmic ways, and then you have to look at, okay, what are the biases that creep into the algorithms? How effective are they? So there's a whole nother layer on to the argument beyond just the philosophical.
Yeah. You know, that made me think of a law that just got passed in France that goes the exact opposite direction. It mandates that social networks take away within 24 hours of publication or of flagging any content that is obviously illegal. And the obviously is very important, that anyone would agree is illegal. But it's interesting that in France, we're saying you have to do more and you have to find a way. We don't care how you do it, moderation or whatever. Just hire an army of moderator if you have to, of moderators. But yeah, in France, they now it's getting into effect in July. Social networks have to take off the content that is flagged, and that is obviously illegal within 24 hours.
Yeah, that's pretty
I don't fast. Know if that's better, honestly. I don't know. But.
Well, it's all a great experiment. We'll find out.
Yeah.
Let us know how it goes, Ben.
Yeah, give us call back in a few months, yeah. Let's take a little break. We're going to talk about happy stuff. There was a very happy event that we all watched together yesterday, and we'll talk about that. That might be something to cheer us up in a minute. But first, a word from our sponsor, as they say. And in this case, it's MasterClass. You know, sometimes and I love MasterClass because I can watch it on my Apple TV. You can watch it on your computer and your phone. And sometimes there's nothing on the air that suits. And I will turn to MasterClass and I invariably learn something. I'm entertained. I enjoy. And I think a lot of that goes to the 75 plus amazing people who teach at MasterClass. How about learning about the art of negotiation from a former FBI hostage negotiator, Chris Voss, or presidential history from Doris Kearns Goodwin? How about learning about interior design from Kelly Wurstler, who's a very well-known designer, or advertising from Goodby and Silverstein? You're learning from the very best. As you can see here, I'm watching Steve Martin's fabulous series on comedy. I am not a funny guy, but Steve sure gave me some great ideas. I'm never going to dance ballet, but watching Misty Copeland teach you about ballet is phenomenal. Aaron Sorkin on screenwriting, Samuel L. Jackson on acting, Judd Apatow on comedy writing. I can go on and on. How about Thomas Keller, one of the world's greatest chefs? Or Garry Kasparov, the world chess champion, teaching you chess. This is the beauty of MasterClass. Some of the new stuff, like David Sedaris just started his course. It's so fantastic. They're beautifully shot. Jodie Foster teaching acting. They're beautifully shot. They're absolutely entertaining. And yet at the same time, I just have to say I love these. I love these. Now, I want you to get involved in MasterClass. We've got a great deal for you. This is a wonderful gift for anybody who is perhaps a graduate. You got any graduates in your life right now? Or maybe Father's Day's coming up? MasterClass lets you learn from the best. You get exclusive access to online classes taught by the masters. Mexican cooking from Gabriela Camara. I get so hungry just watching the classes. Look at that. That's the editor of Vogue, Anna Wintour, teaching you about fashion. Gardening from Ron Finley. Annie Leibovitz teaching you how to do portrait photography. It's an immersive learning experience. classes on all kinds of topics, only the best people teaching. I mean, just amazing. Each class is broken down into individual video lessons. There's downloadable materials. You explore your own pace. I like the you can binge them, of course, but they're 10 to 15 minutes in length. So all it takes is 10 or 15 minutes. You get cooking classes, for instance, come with beautiful downloadable guides. They look like a cookbook, beautiful high-level cookbook. Masterclass is amazing. Masterclass is the way to learn. Chris Hadfield, you want to talk about space. Commander Hadfield's on there. David Lynch. Some of the people you've heard about and thought about for years. You ever been to Franklin's Barbecue in Austin? Of course not, because the line starts at 6 in the morning. But you can get Aaron Franklin teaching you how to smoke. Oh, baby. Oh, my mouth's watering just looking at him slicing that brisket. Masterclass. Get unlimited access to every masterclass. And because you're listening to the show, you'll get 15% off the annual all-access pass when you go to masterclass.com/twit. And really consider this as a gift. This I was going to give it to my son when he graduated from college. He said, I already have it, Dad. Masterclass.com/twit, 15% off. Of course, Gordon Ramsay teaching. Now, Gordon could teach either how to cook or how to yell at cooks. I'm not sure. I'll have to watch that one. Masterclass.com/twit. I love it. You will too. What a great gift. And if you've got some time at home these days, this might be a good way to spend it. Something productive. Learn to shoot three-point dunks with Steph Curry. Speaking of watching, Saturday, did you all watch the launch?
Yes.
I feel like
live.
Definitely.
Yeah. I feel like we needed something to lift us off this sad planet. And the other thing that's so cool is, and I don't know if this is, well, it's 21st century space. First time the U.S. has launched humans into space since 2011. Of course it's going to look futuristic and modern and straight out of a sci-fi movie. Now, I can't show any video, by the way. I showed it on the Tech Guy yesterday. We were showing from the NASA channel, which I believe is a government channel paid for by our tax dollars. For some reason, National Geographic thinks it owns it. So National Geographic, if I put any video from the launch, apparently National Geographic, and I'm not alone, people all over YouTube are complaining about this one. They claim to own that footage, which we all paid for. But congratulations to Elon Musk. It's a beautiful spacecraft. Oh, I got to show a picture. I can't show the video. Can I show a picture? Okay, imagine.
It's a very good example of how machine moderation doesn't always work perfectly.
Out of control. But I have a feeling, I mean, Elon's got to have some influence in this. Like the astronauts, Doug and Bob, get in the Dragon X, and they're all suited up, and then they press a button, and just like in a car, the seats rotate back. So the giant touch screens are right in front of them. It looks like the inside of a Tesla, all molded. Is it plastic? It must be molded plastic. It's beautiful. The spacesuits alone look like something out of a Interstellar or something.
Thoughts? You know, the thing that got me, Leo, was how much light there was coming into the capsule.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember watching videos of the old Apollo launches, and everything looked so cramped and so tight, and these tiny windows. But then you looked at the Dragon capsule and you saw what appeared to be large windows and light coming in everywhere.
Streaming in. It was bright. Yeah. There was also, as soon as they got at 0G, a little dragon started floating through the cabin, which I thought was cool. That was apparently chosen by the crew's sons. That was their indicator that they were in 0G.
I think they said it was an apatosaurus.
It's an apatosaurus. A sequined apatosaurus. I'm sure that was a younger son who said that. It's really, can I show this? I feel like I'm, there's a definite chilling effect. Thank you, National Geographic. It's pretty cool. I don't know if it, I think in some ways it could backfire because there are some small number of people who think the whole thing's fake anyway, who are going to just use all of this and say, look, obviously, it's completely fake.
I don't think they need that to think that.
No, I guess not.
It really was a wonderful thing to watch. I watched it with a friend of mine, and we were talking. We were both watching it while we were streaming, flipping back and forth between either what was on cable or on YouTube or and it was really interesting to sort of watch that with, you know, a friend of mine and it, who are both into space and kind of have a shared experience together and really sort of see something that, you know, we haven't seen in almost a decade. And I grew up with the shuttle. You know, I'm too young to remember the Apollo missions, but, you know, there's still that kind of, you know, pull to space. And, you know, if I had the $30 million or whatever it would cost to take a private ride to space, I'd be right there.
I would, too. I'm a little too old now to do this, but, boy, what an amazing thing. Are they aboard? John would know because he's our space expert. They're aboard the ISS now. The docking was earlier. Was it this morning? Yeah, and it went beautifully. Of course, the Dragon X has autopilot. It was able to dock autonomously. Really, it's, you know, I have to say, it's not, you could probably make the case that we don't need to do this, or, you know, maybe we should, the money would be better spent solving our myriad obvious problems on Earth. But I think there is some value to looking to the stars and giving us hope in some of our darkest hour. And I certainly felt that way yesterday watching the launch, and it was just quite amazing. This is the inside of the Dragon X capsule, which I swear to God looks just like a Tesla.
And I love that they rode out in Teslas.
Yeah.
Elon really gets how to put on a show. He's a bit.
Who's the better marketer, NASA or Elon? Yeah. They're both pretty darn good.
Yeah. That NASA's administrator, Jim, I don't know how to say his last name, Bridenstine, maybe.
Yeah.
He was so eloquent and inspiring and just professional and polished. And I was really impressed by him. And then my other just favorite takeaway was Jim was being so eloquent and saying diplomatic things about international partners in response to a press question, Elon quipped, "The trampoline is working," which referred to the fact that a senior Russian official in their space program during the middle of all the tensions between the U.S. and Russia and debate about whether they were still going to take our astronauts up said, maybe we should use a trampoline to send astronauts to space. So,
oh, Lord.
Yes.
The 27-inch touchscreens. I think that's a nice touch. Remember those? And Bill, I am old enough to have gone all the way back to Mercury watching every single launch with Uncle Walter Cronkite watching the As Man Goes to the Moon. And they had toggle switches and dials. These were like the craziest. They looked like Soviet Union power plants. Now it's a lot cleaner. And they even have little, handles for the astronauts with switches on them so they can hold on. Plus, I'm very gratified to see that you no longer have to have perfect eyesight to be an astronaut.
There's still hope for
us blind old guys.
These guys aren't terribly young.
No, but they are test pilots, which is about the, from my point of view, the highest rank you can achieve in life.
And the farthest away from our physical condition.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder if they have failover systems for these giant touch screens, because in my experience, those sometimes don't work.
Well, I thought about that too.
Can you imagine the stresses? I mean, these look like LCD panels. They must be specially designed to handle the G-forces, the shaking and all of that. But I do wonder if switches might not be more reliable. I don't know.
You know, that makes me think the the stark difference between, first of all, what you said, you know, it's pretty obvious, but we didn't need to go to the moon, although there was the space race and the geopolitical aspect of it. But there were issues on Earth back then, too, that might have been better to deal with. And it doesn't mean you can't, you know, think like that, or you never do anything at all, ever, about anything.
Right.
But it did make me think about Bill Gates' nuclear power plants projects, which he is arguing.
This is, by the way, the early Apollo spacecraft. I just thought I'd show. No, it's not. That is literally a Soviet Union era nuclear power plant. This is actually a fantastic series of Soviet control rooms at designyoutrust.com. If you love gauges, knobs, and dials.
That's impressive.
but really, those spacecraft didn't look like that. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. That's the whole point. The spacecrafts looked like that. And the power plants were designed in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
The power plants we're still using today. And Bill Gates' argument is that if we designed power plants today with modern technology and insight, they are not only incredibly safe, but also, very efficient.
Well, that is one huge difference between the Apollo program and this SpaceX launch is computers and computer power and what computers can do. It's very, very different these days. There's an actual picture of the Apollo on the left, black and white. And then what is that? That is a Boeing aircraft. A shuttle. Oh, that's the shuttle. It looks like an aircraft. And then in the lower right, the 2001 Space Odyssey version, which is the Dragon X capsule. I even think the suits and especially the helmets were designed with photogeneity in mind, it seems.
Yeah, Elon admitted to that. He said, I paid a lot of attention. I had a lot of involvement in the design of the spacesuits. And we want to strike that balance between looking dead ass cool, and he didn't say that, but
no, I think he did actually. I think that's probably exactly what he said.
but his point was, we want to inspire people, we want to inspire kids to want to grow up and be astronauts.
Yeah, I mean, and NASA's very well aware and has always been aware of the fact that they've got to get funding, that it is not an automatic thing, and it's a fraction of the federal budget, but it's often a contentious battle to get funding. And, they're very aware of public relations. Even the stream, which a lot of it came from SpaceX, but it was a NASA stream, felt like it was aimed at high schoolers. There was a lot of cool and wow and hey. And sure, I'm all for that. You know, do the PR thing if that's what it takes to get the funding you need to get into space. And it is dead ass cool. As long as they work, as long as they're safe, I don't.
That was the big worry, right? Because you saw the failure of the Starship prototype, right before the launch. So you know, two completely different systems. One's a prototype. One's been the Falcon 9 and Dragon tested extensively. So you know, I don't think there was any concern there, but still. You know, you saw that juxtaposition of these two kind of systems. And, it gives you a little bit of pause. You want it to work. You want it to be amazing and inspiring and show us the best of what we can accomplish as opposed to some of the worst of our human nature.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's it. We see a lot of the worst, especially these days. It'd be nice to see something hopeful to literally lift our eyes to the stars. Not a bad thing. And relatively speaking, not that expensive. Is there video of the Dragon X failure? It wasn't a Dragon X. Oh, it was the Starship. Okay. I have a space-addled crew. John really loves all this stuff, and I'm with you. Here it is. Yeah, do you want to see it in 4K slow-mo? Maybe not. Oh,
ooh.
Lord above. I had to say, last night I watched Steve Carell and the new Netflix show, which was, it's called Space Force, which
I'm six episodes in.
And they feature that explosion or something a lot like it in the first or second episode. So it's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
It's far more sort of poignant and thoughtful than I thought it would be.
It's not broad.
It's nice.
Do they explain why his wife's in jail at any point?
Not yet. Not in episode. I'm in episode six. Nope.
She's so funny. She's so great. It's a great cast. John Malkovich doing TV.
Yeah. But he's good.
He's really good. He is perfectly cast.
Yes.
So that is it. If you do have Netflix, that is, I think, worth watching. It's a Space Force. A little political. A little bit. Speaking of Apollo 11, Google has postponed, I don't know, that's a bad segue, Android 11. That's a particularly bad segue. We were going to stream this unveiling of the next version of Android. Google's showing, I think, a little bit of sensitivity, decided to postpone it, they say, due to the unrest in the United States in light of the protests. We're excited to tell you more about Android 11, but now's not the time to celebrate, Google posted on its Android developers website. So we will not be streaming that. Although Sony does not have the same concerns, and they're going to stream a bunch of PlayStation 5 game footage on June 4th. We'll probably stream that instead. Let's take another break, and we'll talk about. I wanted to put one really nice, happy story in there, SpaceX. Then we're going to get back to the depressing stuff in just a little bit. I'm sorry about that. Our show today brought to you by LastPass is ready to help you take your workforce home. It's always important to have a plan for the unexpected. Who knew that here we are in almost in June and you'd have, you know, your workforce working out of the house, far away from IT, far away from security. But the good news is LastPass can be deployed quickly in the midst of any event to make sure your business keeps running smoothly and every employee login is secure. I'm really glad that I've been using LastPass personally for 10 years. I'm really glad we moved to LastPass for the business a few years ago because we do have a lot of people working at home. And you know what that means? If they're working from home, they're logging in to our bank accounts, our databases, our websites, all of the most important stuff, our VPNs, our systems here at work from their house. Knowing they're using LastPass puts my mind at ease. More importantly, it puts Russell's mind at ease. Russell's responsible for our IT and security. LastPass does this in a few ways. Of course, you all know it's the best password manager. And, you know, we still need to use passwords a lot. Enterprise password management ensures the oversight of shadow IT and enforceable policies across all password-protected accounts. We require, for instance, two-factor, and we have certain minimum standards for master passwords, things like that. But LastPass has gone beyond just the password vault. They use single sign-on now. In fact, there are 1,200-plus single sign-on apps that work with LastPass. So your employees can log in using their phone, and it gives you in IT a centralized view. So you always have complete insight into who has access to what from where. That's really important with people all over the place. And then there's LastPass's multi-factor authentication, also a new feature in the LastPass Enterprise. Of course, it'll use biometric like Touch ID, Face ID, but it will also use contextual factors, geolocation, IP address, to make sure that only the right employees are accessing the right resources. This is so important. And you will be glad to know LastPass never sends or stores a master password. If it can't access your data, that means hackers can't either. Encryption happens exclusively at the device level before syncing to LastPass for safe storage, so only users can decrypt their data. LastPass protects while providing a seamless workflow for your employees. Account access and passwords can be shared securely between employees, even offsite. Again, this is very important, whether they're in the office or remote. Employees will get secure access to their work applications with SSO, password management. There's an offline mode, which is great. Sometimes employees don't have the same great internet service you do at work, so they can still get their passwords and even multi-factor authentication, even when the internet is a little spotty. LastPass can help make remote work simple and secure. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help you and your business stay productive and secure no matter what. LastPass.com/twit. We had a great LastPass panel last month. It was so much fun with Steve Gibson and Jerry Buchelt from Log Me In, their CISO, Andrew Keen. We're planning the next one in the fall. If you've got ideas for what you'd like, send me an email or mention it in the chat room. I have an idea. I haven't run this by LastPass. I want to get a hacker panel. I want to get people who, you know, and we know a few hackers. We have some friends. Get some people in. If they want, they can, you know, wear a mask and we'll change their voice. But I want to get people in to talk about how hackers attack and how they try to breach your security and what they do. I think that would be fascinating. I mean, we're planning that for September, so stay tuned. Details still to come. We're talking about the Week in Tech with Denise Howell. Always great to see you. You did a great AMA last week. That was fun. Thank
you.
That
was so fun. Those after hours things that you're doing on Fridays are really fun and cool.
We're really enjoying them. I don't know if it's, you know, I mean, it's not a revenue. It's not a moneymaker, that's for sure. But it's a lot of fun. I think it's good. I think it's good for our employees, and I know it's good for our audience. I think it's fun. This week we did the YouTube stars, which was really great. We had Father Robert Ballasser, Renee Ritchie, and the return of OMG Chad, who used to produce my shows and work for Twit.
Remember, 10 years
ago, he started a little Minecraft show on Twit called OMG Craft. He broke 1 million subscribers this past week on YouTube. So we thought we'd have him in along with Renee and Robert and talk about YouTube stardom. And then they also played a kind of a Pictionary game. That was kind of fun. So we've done so many of them. We're going to do more, too. I don't know what we're doing next week, but Fridays, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7. Do you know, John?
No.
I see your eyebrows going up.
We find out Wednesday afternoon.
Yeah, we don't find out till Wednesday. They're planning it. They're thinking about it. 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. We will do that on Friday. And maybe we'll keep doing it after quarantine's over. I don't know. It's a lot of fun. We did have a good week. In fact, I bet you we have some clips from this week's After Hours right here.
Previously on Twit.
I'm going to look down underneath me. What are you doing down there, Padre?
Oh, you know, just doing my thing overseas in the land of, I guess, Caroma.
What time is it in the land of Caroma?
It is now 1:06 a.m., so it's, you know, it's just about time for me to start the day.
Hands on Android.
I'm going to show you some advanced tips and tricks with Assistant, things that you may not have heard of, hidden deeper, and in conjunction with some other apps, which I'll talk about, you can do a whole lot more with Assistant.
Hands on Photography.
This week on Hands on Photography, we're going to do something just a little bit different while we do this shelter-in-place photography project.
iOS Today.
There are a lot of people studying at home now.
And a lot of parents sort of having to fill in the gaps. I think it might be good to do an episode where we talk about how to help them and how to teach them and maybe to sort of refresh yourself on some of those concepts.
This Week in Google.
This lickable screen can recreate almost any taste or flavor without eating food. Now, see, I need that. They've invented what is being described as a taste display.
I could get this device that would simulate the flavor of my bean and cheese burrito.
Twit. Technology for your eyes and ear holes.
Jeff Jarvis on This Week in Google. He misses his Taco Bell like nobody's business. So we all got, was it last week or the week before? We all got the Google and Apple API on our phones. I've got it on my iPhone. I think I've got it on my Google phone as well. The only problem with it is nobody wants to use it. France said, what are you, crazy? Germany backed down. They said eventually they're going to use it. The first use of it, I think, is going to be in Switzerland. They've already started releasing an app in test. I don't think they've released it to the general populace, called Exposure Notification. Are they? What are they doing? Oh, Latvia. Oh, Latvia is going to use it too. What are they doing in Finland? Is there any app?
I haven't heard about an app in Finland because the efficiency of the apps is kind of an unknown, especially if you don't have a lot of people adopting it, and no one wants to make it mandatory for understandable reasons. But you glossed over the French thing. It is completely baffling what is happening with the French version of the contact tracing app, which is called Stop COVID. And they decided to sort of plant their flag, the government decided to plant their flag on this as a political / technological battle to kind of fight the dominance of Google and Apple and say, we don't need to use that version because our version is better. There are two competing standards, both of which being pretty good in theory, some with, you know, there are good and bad aspects to both. But the issue is with the French version, since it's not using the validated API by Google and Apple, it doesn't have free access to the Bluetooth system on iOS. And we've had hands-on, a few tech publications have had hands-on with the app as it's been tested. It's releasing tomorrow, I believe. But the access to Bluetooth is very intermittent. Sometimes when the phone is woken up, it has access to Bluetooth. Sometimes, of course, when you launch it, it has access to it. But there are many time windows where it doesn't have access to Bluetooth, so it doesn't communicate the proximity.
Apple's basically made it, you have to use our API or you're not going to have a useful app.
Which is, yeah, it's absolutely the case. But for those who don't know, that it's ironic because for almost a decade, we've been saying, oh, the tech giants have too much control. And in this specific case, it's Apple and Google working together who can ensure the governments don't have too much power. Right. With these apps, because they could be used, you know, they could be used to track location, to gather data about you. It could be a doorway to a nightmare surveillance scenario. And Apple and Google did things very right. They implemented a lot of safeguards. It's very well done, their system.
It's well done, although I think a lot of people, including Bruce Schneier, who I trust, say it's a non-starter only because no app is going to be successful in contact tracing. You need human contact tracers. Schneier's contention was there are two problems with any app, false positives, false negatives. False positives because an app that uses Bluetooth or proximity might make a mistake if you drive by somebody or, you know, you're on the other side of a barrier, but they can't tell, but it will say you've been exposed. That's a problem. There's also the false negative problem where not 100% of everybody's using it, you go in a store, you can't assume that you haven't been exposed just because your app says, well, you didn't run into anybody running the app that's tested positive. So all of this means very low level of trust in these apps, which means a very low level of adoption. And by the way, in countries like Singapore where they have apps that don't use the API, adoption is around 20%. It's not going to be very effective. I want to point out a great article by Zach Hall at 9to5Mac. He's keeping it up to date on which states are using it. And only four U.S. states have said they're going to use the Apple Exposure API. Alabama, North Dakota, South Carolina, and Virginia. He also talked to health officials at each state. And many states have, for instance, California says, we don't have any app updates on apps at all. But if that changes, we'll let you know. Many states are just not going the app route. They're instead trying to hire human contact tracers, which is going to be an even more intrusive conversation than any app.
Yeah, but the contact tracing, the test and trace, which has been put in place in extensively in Asia, is more intrusive for the person that you know that has been affected that has tested positive. And that is important to get information on. The issue with apps, or the potential issue with apps, would be the mass surveillance it can implement, because everyone should install them if you want them to be efficient.
But I think Google and Apple have done a very good job, right? They don't ever give anybody else the information. You don't even get the information. It'll say you've been exposed. It doesn't say to whom, and they don't get your so no information is exchanged with anybody. It's all it's deleted after a period of time.
After 14 days, you get basically IDs that are renewed every 15 minutes, and they don't get your location. They just get the IDs of the phones that you've been
It's not even tied to you, right? It's not tied to you.
It's not. In that system, it isn't. In the French system, which is using the Robert protocol, it is tied to one pseudonymized ID, which then they can use to run, statistical analysis and things that could be useful. But of course, now they've started releasing the source code, as they had promised, which is very much necessary. We're finding that there are many security issues in the implementation that they have chosen, apparently. But even beyond that, the issues with these apps are so many, and not everyone has a smartphone, almost everyone. But when you need
to, you don't have to have 100% because you want to bring the R not down. And if you had 70 or 80%, compliance.
Yeah, but even even if you are at your target is 50%, there are 70 to 80% of people who have smartphones.
Right.
Out of those, only 70% or so have smartphones that can run, that are on the OS that can run the apps. And so out of those, everyone should install the app in order to reach that level. But the important thing to keep in mind is that the solution that Apple and Google are offering is an API that is saying, we don't know if it's going to work. We don't know if you want to use it, but this is the safest option we can offer. Now, maybe it doesn't work, but if we don't have that, which is controlled by us and adheres to the strictest standards of security, then we don't know what's going to happen, because we don't know what other systems or government are going to do with these systems that are implemented. So it's kind of a safety net. Even if it doesn't work, it's important to have it. But the reality is the thing, it seems, I'm not an expert, but everything I've read seems to point towards the fact that the app is probably not going to help much. And the thing that really helps is test and trace, direct interviews, and that kind of thing.
Although, if the app were willing to violate privacy, it could be very useful. If a contact trace, if I test positive and the contact tracer can come to me and say, well, I'd like to know everywhere you've been and everyone you've run into in the last 14 days. If my phone's been recording that and can hand that information over, that makes their job a lot more easier and a lot more effective. I don't know if I could remember everybody I've run into.
Yes and no, because it gives you the exact location you've been, but then you still need to talk to people to ask. So you were in.
But they're going to do that. In contact tracing, the first thing they say is, where have you been in the last 14 days?
Yeah.
And if I could say, it's on my phone. And actually, it is, because I let Google do that. So I'm doing it for a reason. Okay, just to prove your point, and this is not exactly this, it's apples and oranges here, but it's from Boy Genius Report. According to Minnesota Public Safety Commissioner John Harrington, officials in Minnesota have been using what they describe, without going into much detail, as contact tracing in order to build out a picture of protester affiliations.
There you go.
So that's the problem with a tool like this.
And there's the slippery slope.
The other question I have is whether Apple and Google are going to block apps that don't use their API.
Well, that's France's problem, right? If I write an app as the government of France, apps on iOS don't have access to Bluetooth, this kind of beaconing information. Is that right, Patrick? Is that the issue?
Yeah, exactly. Because Bluetooth is restricted for security and battery saving issues, especially on iOS. It depends on the version of Android, but some of them have that too. But Apple and Google have said that only official governmental or, you know, official administration apps could use that kind of technology. So my guess, I haven't looked into this specifically, but my guess is they're policing the app stores for these kinds of apps. So you can't have, you know, any app doing anything with these, because you have security measures on those devices anyway, right? And this is why, as you said, the French app doesn't work well, because you can't, by default on the system, use these features.
States have already started hiring tens of thousands of contact tracers. But I have to say, just this conversation illustrates why I think it's a non-starter in the United States. I don't think we're going to give up information like that.
No, but it's important to distinguish the two. We touched on them earlier. And surprisingly, we've had these kinds of discussions in France as well from a few people saying, oh, but we're building a database with people who have been sick on COVID-19, who have tested positive on COVID-19, the government shouldn't know who's been, you know, we're sort of losing. As much as I am very cautious and actually antagonistic towards the apps, for the people who test positive, this is how you solve it.
Public health, you know, this requires.
Yes. My conclusion.
Test, trace, and isolate. It's the only thing that works.
Do our behaviors impact whether these apps can work, do you think?
What do you mean? Give me an example.
Like the demonstrations we've seen, and then the post-demonstration rioting that we've seen over the last few days in several large cities. You know, whether you're talking to your contact tracer human being or you're participating in an app, if you've been around that many people in that close proximity, does that just flood the system?
It can handle it in theory.
It can?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
In theory. But first of all, we don't know a hell of a lot how the virus spreads. So if I'm and I don't know how much information is recorded by the API, but if I'm in contact with somebody for a second outdoors, and that
you can put a threshold. Yes, you can put a threshold and keep basically record the ID of the person you've been in contact with or of the phone which your phone has been close to for 15 minutes, then it tags it. If it wasn't, you know, you can.
But that's an assumption. See, this is the problem with, honestly, this is the problem with big tech. And even Bruce Schneier says that. They solve the problems they can solve. They didn't really, they based it on an assumption. We don't know. Is it 15 minutes? Is it half an hour? Is it 5 minutes? We don't know. We actually literally.
And it may depend on what you're doing.
And what are you doing? Are you singing? Or are you pantomiming makes a difference?
All of these things are true. But again, these systems by Apple and Google were designed because they knew that this was coming. They knew that governments and health authorities were saying maybe this could be used to help. And they designed them with the strongest possible security features while still making everything that these apps would want to do possible, as much as possible. And I am convinced the app, well, it seems most people are convinced the apps are going to do very little. There was, I think, in Norway or Iceland, a police force that was in charge of the contact tracing interviews, which also had access to an app that was installed, I think, up to 50 or 60% of the population. And they also said it was negligible. There were one or two cases where it was like, oh, okay, you didn't remember, you went there, and they were using GPS data,
right,
which might be better or worse than Bluetooth, and it was marginal, the benefits. But still, it's important to have that Apple and Google system which respects privacy, because if you don't, then everyone does what they want, and we know what happens.
But you can't. But health.
But it doesn't.
Public
work.
Health
doesn't
requires. It doesn't matter. Public health, right, requires your breach privacy. This is part of the. Denise, do you think we could ever do this in the United States? We don't even want to wear masks.
Right. Very true. EFF has a good article on it where they're pointing out exactly the conundrum that you are, Leo, that in order to be the most effective app, you're going to have it be centralized and more intrusive. And in order to respect people's privacy, it's going to be decentralized like the Apple and Google API is mostly, which, you know, is more protective of other concerns, but not as effective in squashing the virus. So it just depends, I guess, how prevalent the virus is and how scared people are and what sort of trade-offs they're willing to make.
It's a shame that we so little trust our government. I mean, that's also part of it. It's how much do you trust the government? Do you assume mm-hmm. that the government, having been given this information, will then use it in other ways? Or do you assume your government is benevolent and is using it for public health? If you don't trust the government, you're not going to trust contact tracing. It's just not going to work.
And but even if you do trust the government generally, people lie, right? I mean, for a variety of reasons. I mean, they may have fear, they may forget, they may they may not provide accurate information, which you need during a public health crisis, right? So it's just like in a criminal investigation, you know, if you go up and you ask somebody, hey, did you see this? What happens? Were you there? Then that information can be used in ways maybe you didn't anticipate. You know, you weren't a subject of the investigation, but you provided evidence. And then all of a sudden you're caught up in that. So it really is a difficult, I think it's almost impossible for us to roll this out in the U.S. I really do. From, you know, looking at the current climate and sort of very divisive political environment that we have right now, I just don't think there's a lot of interest in allowing the government to watch us any more than we already do. And so, you know, I just don't see people installing it voluntarily. And I think it would be very, very difficult for any state or the federal government to mandate that this be put on phones. I think you'd see a lot of uproar, even with the public health crisis. I think we'd have to be on the edge of just absolute societal breakdown before people would willingly go along with this.
And the closer we get to that, the less likely they are. It's odd because 100,000 people dying in 3 months seems like a pretty big crisis to me.
Yeah. No, but I agree with Bill, and I
don't know. What do you want? Yeah. A million?
The apps don't matter. The apps, you know, people, they have to be voluntarily installed, and people aren't going to install them. I'm confused whether you're talking about contact tracing via apps.
No, I'm not. Again, I'm talking about human contact tracing. Apps, okay. It's apparent apps won't work. It's very apparent.
And human contact tracing is key. If you don't accept that, then you're going to have a big problem for a long time.
Well, I don't think we're going to. I don't think if the guy comes to the door and says, you've been in contact with somebody who has tested positive. I need to know everywhere you've been in the last 14 days and everyone you've seen. I would say at least half of Americans will slam the door in his face. Right?
I'm going to tell you everywhere I've been except for those two people that I really don't want you to know about. Right. I
mean, yes, or they'll
that's
lie.
The better than,
yeah,
have the
that's better than
the ideal situation. We have the real world.
Right. So
and I think people would be upset to even realize that the latest update to their phone's operating system has added this capability.
It's already in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure they are. We when we first started talking about this, the TWIT panel just basically said it's a non-starter, period. Never installing it. Now, that was a few weeks ago. Maybe people, I don't know. By the way, here's some good news. I'm sure Jack Dorsey would be glad to hear this. France says Twitter would be welcome if it decides to leave the United States.
Well, not after that law that Patrick mentioned.
I don't think Twitter's going to the U.S. This is the U.S., the French junior digital affairs minister. You're going to have to explain this to me. His name is Cedric O, not E-A-U-O. Yep. Just the letter O. Is that his real name?
Yeah, it is.
You can have a one-letter name in France?
Well, it's his name. It's just his name.
Okay. Anyway, he said...
Can we match up his offspring with Elon Musk's offspring?
Yeah, Ash O. Yeah. He said this appropriately in an interview on Radio J.
If Twitter would consider at some point that the U.S. circumstances could no longer allow the company to develop according to its values and to continue to expand, and if there would be too much instability for various reasons, the company would obviously be welcome in Europe, particularly in France. I don't know if it's that obvious.
I think, you know, all of these things, I think Twitter doesn't really want
to
leave
the France. No. Although the food and the coffee's better, but and that's important.
They can telecommute. So it's just a question of, right? They can all telecommute.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Jack has said you don't ever have to come back to work. Mm-hmm. The
Why
company could be anywhere. You know what? If I were Jack, I'd probably consider moving to somewhere like the Cayman Islands.
Well, that's what I was going to say, Leo. Are any of these large multinational corporations actually beholden to any one country anymore? I mean, you look at, they all have to operate in China. They all have to operate in Russia. They operate in the U.S. They operate in South America or in the Middle East and the Arabian Peninsula. They operate everywhere. So I'm not necessarily sure, you know, an invitation from any one company or, country, you know, would be enticing enough unless it's really low taxes.
Right. Well, I'm sure there are countries you could go to. There'd be no taxes and no rules.
And those countries, not France.
Not France. I know. I know. Honestly, that's not the best place to go, Jack. What about maybe get one of those abandoned oil, deep sea oil rigs and start a little country out there? You could have the Twitter land. Just have your own country.
Thing is, they still, in order to make money, they have to operate in those countries.
Money.
And there are ways of restricting it.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to operate in a country if that country doesn't want to operate there, doesn't want you to operate.
Whatever happened to Sealand? Is that still around? You can, I think, still. Oh, yeah, you can still. It was founded in 1967 in international waters, 7 miles off the shore of Britain, as a sovereign principality. And you can still become a lord or lady of Sealand. It's got passports. Maybe this is where Twitter should move.
Weren't they trying to run a data center out of there for a while?
Yeah.
I remember that years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
See, it doesn't look like it has room for Jack's shower.
Now, if you want to become a count or countess, that'll be £200. If you want to become a duke or duchess, that's £500. If you want to become a lord or lady, that's only £30. What's the difference?
That's a bargain.
I'd say go for the £30. Honestly, Lord Laporte of Sealand. Oh, boy. I guess there's not much more to say about the testing. I'm really curious what's going to look like. Actually, be honest, what is July going to look like in the United States?
I think that's to be determined. You know, you've got
TBD.
States that are starting to open up.
Yeah.
And, you know, we won't know how that's going to affect the rate of infection for another probably 4 weeks. So, you know, we'll have to see. They, you know, you saw the headlines out of that pool party that they had.
Oh, yeah.
There were hundreds of people there. Yeah, yep. Somebody tested positive. So what's that going to lead to?
Yep.
This is something we've been experiencing a little bit. We started reopening both in France and Finland a couple of weeks ago. And so a couple of things. First, people bandy the number about the number of deaths in the U.S. And of course, it's a lot. But keep in mind, if you bring it to the ratio to population, mm-hmm. it is roughly in the middle of the pack in Western countries. France has like doubled the number of deaths per million people compared to the U.S. So that's one thing to keep in mind.
Yeah, but and of course, I'm not comparing. It's kind of meaningless to say death per thousand. It's 100,000 deaths. That's 100,000 dead people. People who would otherwise be alive. That's not.
Yes.
Trivial.
No, it's France, awful. But Patrick's point about population is a good one, and I never see it adequately.
We have a giant population compared
to
other
countries. Whatever proportion of the world's population, and the coronavirus deaths are.
I'm not saying it's worse here than anywhere else or better here than anywhere else. I'm just saying there hasn't been a lot of acknowledgement that that's a lot of people. That's almost twice as many people as died in Vietnam.
I didn't mean to launch into that debate, but so 2 weeks after we started ending the lockdown, we are not seeing a significant second wave here. Actually, no second wave at all. The decrease is continuing on all metrics. And it seems that the factors, at least for now, it might change tomorrow, but the big factors are social distancing is still implemented as much as we can within the end of the lockdown. The you know, coughing, wearing masks, coughing in your arm, all of that, and test and trace. That is,
what is the situation in Finland? Do you have active cases, or have you gone down to almost nothing, or?
Very few. Finland woke up at the same time as every other Western country, mid-March. But the infection, the epidemic hadn't reached us too much. So it was, I think, in the hundreds cases of people sick and hospitalized. And we had maybe 100 deaths total. Maybe
320. I'm looking right now. 320 total.
Okay, there.
Yeah. That's a good number. It's a small country. I mean,
it's 5 million people.
Yeah.
So, but it's also, you know, the population density is a lot lower. And,
And I think, you know, Leo, we were talking about this. I think the last time I was on, it was sort of early in the pandemic, and we were kind of wondering what the future of work would look like.
Yeah.
And as we move through this. And so I think that's really, you know, to Patrick's point is, what is this going to, and to yours, what is this going to look like? You know, are people, a lot of big companies have already said, you don't have to come back to work. You know, there's no plans for me to actually go back into an office.
But did you go into an office before?
I did, actually.
Okay. Republic has some nice offices in Louisville, come to think of it.
We have, you know, and a small office compared to, say, some of the offices in SF or in New York. But, you know, how is that going to, you know, what's that going to look like for not just knowledge workers, but actually people in retail and people in service industries and the healthcare industries? I just think we're still in for several months of, if not a new normal for, you know, the foreseeable future, you know, if not permanently. You know, we saw it after SARS. We saw a mask culture, you know, and I wish that, you know, unfortunately, you know, we have some folks in the U.S. who see masks as some kind of equivalent to political correctness or as a political issue. It should be a public health issue.
The president.
It's strange to me how
the
small
president
things like
of
this
the
get
country.
Yeah.
He told a reporter, oh, you're going to leave your mask on because you're politically correct. No, that's not exactly why.
No, I think we have to do that. We as a society have to get to a point where we say, look, we're going to make these changes. Yes, it is different. You know, we don't go into airports the same way as we did 20 years ago. And that's OK. It's just what we have to do now. And, you know, if restaurants have to have a little bit lower capacity for another year, that's what they have to do. Yeah. If, you know, you have to, you know, if people can't be crammed together into an elevator, then that's what we'll have to do. And I think hopefully those measures will be able to hold that rate of infection flat, even as we do reopen businesses, reopen schools, people do go more out, back out in public.
You know, it's really interesting what is accepted as obvious here in Europe and what is considered contentious for you guys in the U.S.
I actually like wearing a mask. I like the fact that it hides my face ID.
I looked into that early on, Leo, and there are, you know, again, we need to consider who's speaking, but there are outlets in China and Russia who say that they can detect your face even while you're wearing a mask. Yeah.
Google can tell who you are by the way you walk. Mm-hmm. There's a laser that can tell who you are by the rhythm of your heart at 100 yards. So I'm sure it won't take them too long to upgrade that face recognition hardware so they could tell who you are. Let's take a little break. A few more stories a little later on, about 15 minutes, 20 minutes. Baratunde is going to join us. I want to talk a little bit about what's going on in the world around us with the author of How to Be Black and one of our favorite guests on our shows. Our show today brought to you by Worldwide Technology. I'll always remember you, Worldwide Technology. The last trip I took before COVID-19, we went early March, we went to Seattle, and I have to say I'm so glad we did because we saw their Advanced Technology Center. It's mind-boggling. And right now, as people are figuring out what the – it's actually perfect, Bill, what you were talking about. Companies are all over the world are trying to figure out what is work going to look like going forward. Worldwide Technology is there for you. They've always been there for enterprise for more than a decade. You want safety for your employees, but you got to run your critical operations too. You can do both. Worldwide Tech can help with it all. Everything from remote working, home agents, telehealth, even improvised treatment locations. Yeah, they've got expertise in that. Even remote learning solutions. These guys are really amazing. WWT can guide you every step of the way. Let's talk about these one by one. Remote working, of course. Consumer-grade technology helps employees connect with colleagues and execute tasks as if they were in the office. Organizations can now begin to move from urgently responding to a need to maybe going a step beyond those consumer-grade technologies and enhancing the experience of their remote workers. Yeah, we may be in this for a while, so let's do it right. Home agents, enabling contact centers to distribute agents to remote locations of their homes, requires deploying technology that satisfies both technical and process requirements. Your customer service reps can be in their homes. Organizations can balance the needs of customers with the health and safety of those home agents. There's also telehealth, another area of expertise with WWT. Healthcare organizations have to rapidly connect with patients remotely to provide virtual care. This is something we need more than ever. And the technology that can empower providers to connect with patients in their homes and at subacute care facilities and temporary care clinics, that's an area of expertise too. They're great at remote learning. Educational institutions at all levels have to adapt to teaching students from a distance. Don't cobble together a solution. Worldwide Tech can help you with online curriculums, can make sure educators and students have access, can navigate remote learning tools and systems for you. Look, we're in a new world, and organizations are facing this world with new challenges. Leaders are struggling to know what technology decisions they should make to keep their employees safe and productive while still keeping those critical services running. And Worldwide Tech is your partner. Communication for your staff, home setups like audio, webcams, and monitors. Let Worldwide Tech work out the complexities and provide you with guidance that will not only help you maintain business critical operations, but optimize them for the future. Worldwide Tech is there for you. Don't let anything stand in the way of servicing your customers or of keeping business running. Contact WWT today to request a consultation. WWT.com/twit2. Twit and the number 2. That's WWT.com/twit2. WWT, Worldwide Technology, simplifies the complex. WWT.com/twit2. WWT, enabling critical operations for business continuity. They're here for you now, in the future, just as they have been over the last decade or so. They're really great. Worldwide Technology, we're glad to be partnered with them. Perfect sponsor for these difficult times. Don't listen, Bill. Microsoft is laying off 50 journalists to replace them with artificial intelligence. I'm sorry. This has never worked well. Why doesn't Microsoft know that? I mean, everybody's tried this. Google tried it. Apple tried it. Apple ended up hiring more humans, right?
Yeah, you know, it's tough because we kind of touched on this earlier, right? We talked about this seemingly insurmountable problem of moderating thousands of tweets or thousands of posts on, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of posts on Facebook and, you know, trying to use algorithms to do this. And so, Microsoft is going to try the same thing with their the homepage there. So, you know, I don't think it will work very well. You know, I like to think that I'm not just biased, that that's actually sort of a reflection of the nature of the task and humans being able to sort of curate those, you know, the stories that people see. Because, you know, it does go back to what we were talking about earlier. I think that whether it's a social platform or whether it's a news page or whatever it is, algorithms tend to amplify individual behavior. So if I watch something on Facebook, like something on Facebook, if I read a particular type of story, then algorithms tend to pick up on that and usually will promote stories like that to me because that increases my engagement and interaction on the sites, which is the purpose of the sites, to increase the time that I spend there and the information that I give them. So there is something valuable in seeing stories maybe that the algorithm wouldn't promote to me. Now, I haven't seen the inner workings of the algorithm. Maybe that will, you know, they'll incorporate some kind of counter programming. It's like, oh, you're reading too many of these stories. We want to bring you this. Or maybe it won't, you know, have that involved in it. But, you know, I still like to think that the human brain is often the best arbiter and the best curator of information if you know your audience really well.
Yeah. Well, you know, it may also be Microsoft knows better than we do that nobody read Microsoft News. It comes with every version of Windows 10, and it's also an MSN, and it's I think it's part of the Bing group. It's possible that they just said, yeah, no one's reading this, so we can get some robots to do it.
Just give up on it anyway. Yeah, yeah.
Save us money.
It's R&D.
Yeah, exactly. It'll be this week that the House. So we've been covering these Patriot Act reauthorization, in particular, this issue about the FBI getting warrantless searches of our browser history. Warrantless, they could just go to your internet service provider, say, "I'd like Leo's browser history, please." The Senate tried to amend it, failed by one vote. 59 out of 100 senators voted yes. Now the bill is in the House of Representatives. Because you don't have that same supermajority rule, it might be a little easier to get this through. Something to watch. The sponsors of the search privacy amendment in the House are Zoe Lofgren and Warren Davidson of Ohio. So that vote will be this week. It's a simple amendment, but the key is Section 215... that authorities may not seek an order authorizing or requiring the production of internet website browsing information or internet search history information of U.S. persons. They'll need a warrant to do that. Are you following this, Denise?
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, I have a couple of reactions. First, in the wake of Edward Snowden, do we really think that they
doesn't matter
care about having...
They already know everything, I suppose.
But, you know... Warrants are good, and we want them to, you know, whether they're going to
send a message,
listen to it. Yes, exactly. So the interesting thing is that three senators were absent when they did the first vote, where they were off by one vote. So if those three people, who include Lamar Alexander from Tennessee, mm-hmm. Patty Murphy from Washington, and Bernie mm-hmm. Sanders mm-hmm. from Vermont. Oh, mm-hmm. and actually
Ben
there were
Sasse.
Four.
Yeah.
Ben Sasse. Yeah. Yeah. So, If they come back in, any one of them could be the vote that's needed. So,
well, we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing that gets me about all these, Leo and Denise can talk about this probably better than me. Warrants are not that hard to get.
Right.
I mean, especially in the digital age. I mean, there are ways you can have a judge at a baseball game that can sign a warrant electronically on their phone. I mean, the information that has to be provided to get a warrant is fairly low. So if you've got a case at all, you know, against somebody, you can get a warrant. But hopefully what it does do is, you know, Edward Snowden aside, is try to sort of prevent some of the mass surveillance that we saw back during the warrantless wiretapping scandals we had here in the U.S. So, you know, hey, it's a move maybe in the right direction.
At least it casts a light on it.
Yes.
One to watch.
It does seem kind of minor compared to all the other issues we're facing these days. Well, let's see. Something happy. Anybody get HBO Max? Anybody get? You don't have to pay attention to this, Patrick.
I have HBO Nordic. I'm very happy.
You have it?
I have HBO Nordic. I don't know how different it is.
Nordic.
Max or
I
now.
Bet there's a lot of tall, powerfully built blonde people in it.
A lot of the girl with the dragon tattoo.
Yeah.
I have been watching Vikings, so yes.
Vikings is pretty good, actually. I like Vikings. That would be on HBO Nordic. That makes sense.
But I think they launched it a few years ago when they were thinking about understanding that probably at some point they would need to do that. And they thought, which region can we do that easily without being bogged down in licensing issues? And they figured Scandinavia. They all speak English anyway. So let's do that. And it's been working pretty well.
Tan Danner wants to know if they call it HBO Royale in France. Because what's the Big Mac called in France? It's called the
Royale with cheese.
Royale with cheese.
No. Royale is something else, which is really delicious. So the Royale, actually, the issue was all of the burgers from McDonald's were a little bit too savory for too sweet for French taste.
Oh yeah, we put a lot of sugar in those. Yeah.
And so they designed a France specific burger. They called it the Royale, and it's got a pepper sauce that is really, really nice.
Very savory. I remember I got a Big Mac in France. It tasted awful. It was weird.
Because it didn't have.
It wasn't sweet enough, to be honest.
I guess. You know what's interesting?
Don't you guys get high fructose corn syrup there in Paris?
Not as much, no. I always say I love McDonald's, and my American friends look at me completely bewildered. And I realized when I go to the U.S., I actually don't. It's
a different
thing. You don't like our McDonald's.
It's a different thing.
Well, I will agree with Patrick. The best McDonald's I ever had when I was not a vegetarian was in Paris. So, you know, completely different than the McDonald's I was used to here. So
now I feel guilty for eschewing McDonald's anytime I visit. The capital of France. I shall have to try it. Anyway, HBO Max, I think this is the week that they finally pushed us too damn far with too many damn subscriptions. And, you know, Quibi might have been the beginning of the end, but HBO Max, it's just the end. It's like, no. And now Peacock from NBC is due out soon. And it's like, no, enough.
Well, it is hard. And, you know, I can't say we've got our own streaming service, All Access, great CBS product, put in a promo for that.
There you go.
But I wonder about that. I mean, how many streaming services do all of us have? I think I would have to sit here and count them all up that either came with something I have. I got a text. I have AT&T service for my personal cell phone, and they sent me a text and said, oh, by the way, as part of your plan, you now get HBO Max free. I was like, oh, okay. Don't I already have Go through my cable provider? And then, wait a minute, what's this Now thing? What's the difference between Max and Go and Now? Which one do I want?
It's completely confusing. And do I already get it for free? Because you don't want to pay for it. And there's 20 ways to get it for free. So it's very confusing. Thank you, Ashley Esquetha at CNET, who actually went through and ranked every streaming service. Did you know there are more than 100?
Oh, wow.
Number one, Amazon Prime, then Hulu, Netflix, HBO Now, HBO Max, Disney Plus, CBS All Access, Peacock, Acorn TV, and Showtime in the top 10. But there's also Mubi and High Dive and Philo and Crunchyroll and Up Faith and Fandor and Ginx and Hiya.
You know, this is great. Can I defend it for a second?
Yes. This is like an American grocery store. Endless choice.
The internet's disintermediation, which means you can have essentially TV channels for curated niche tastes. You mentioned Crunchyroll. That could mm-hmm. that they tried it many times, you know, have a, at least in France, have a anime, Japanese animation based TV channel. It didn't work. It wasn't possible. It was too expensive. The internet allows the market to support that. And all of these, I'm sure there will be some form of consolidating for these services. There might be too many, but there are many that can serve people who wouldn't have access to that thing that they love in that form.
We wanted disaggregation. We begged them. We said, give us a la carte. It's not quite a la carte, but give us something. I agree, because I subscribe to, like, BritBox, which is, you know, British TV. I subscribe to the Criterion Channel, which is weird old black and white shows. So, you know, it's nice. Yeah, you're right. It's nice to have. What Crunchyroll is what?
Anime. Japanese animation.
Anime. Well, there you see. There you go. Probably should be subscribing to that. I spent all my money getting to a Duchess ship at the Sealand, so I can't do that. If you had the... They didn't tell me Duchess was just for women. Okay. They, if you had an Echo Look camera, I did. I gave it to somebody, though. I don't remember who I gave it to. It's going to stop working in July. This was the camera that goes in your closet, looks at your wardrobe, and tells you if you should never wear that again. I kept, you know, it didn't really do a good job for me, so I gave it. I feel like I gave it to Justine or somebody who could use it. Oh, maybe Georgia Dow. I don't remember. Megan? Megan.
I'm going to miss mine.
Do you have one?
Yes, I have one, and I use it all the time to post to Instagram. I've never used in any sort of thoroughgoing way their stylist advice, which is what it was marketed. You know, you would compare a couple of outfits, and it would tell you, wear that one, not that one. And
but no, you have excellent taste. You have such good style.
Oh, that's so sweet of you.
No, you do.
No, I just use it as their as a camera.
So you can say, take a picture of me and post it on Instagram?
Not directly from their app, but you save it locally and then you can post it. Yeah. That's what my entire Instagram account for the last 2 years has been courtesy of the Echo Look. So I'm going to have to find an alternative.
What are you going to do? Oh, look at all the, this is all Echo Look.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is amazing.
Well, thank you.
That's your whole Instagram. Is this?
Aside from the occasional, hey, I'm going to be on Twit or something.
This is so great. What is going on here, though? I mean, do you want to be an influencer?
What's going on here is, you know, as sort of an adult passion of mine that has taken hold in later life is I really want people to be aware of the textile waste problem in the US and globally. And so almost all, everything I wear is secondhand almost everything. So
Lisa is, my wife is so jealous. She loves your style.
Oh, well,
she thinks you are just so fancy.
But yeah, I'm going to have to talk to Aunt or someone about a good replacement.
Yeah, this is all Echo Look. So, and it's blurring out the background and everything, and that's all just straight out of the look. That's hysterical.
Right.
You have a whole Instagram account based on this.
It has little lighting that's built into it, so you don't have to, it's going to be a pain when it doesn't work anymore, but I'll
live. This is not in your closet, I can see.
No, it's not. It's just, so the reason that it works for me for this purpose is I just, you know, it's on my way out the door. My office is past my bedroom. And as I'm leaving, I can just stop and take a picture and then I'm done. And then, so I just need something that will.
Instagram.com/D Howell. I had no idea. I knew, you know, I could tell you were a fashion plate, but I had no idea that it was secondhand. And the idea was to save textiles. That's really great.
That's the whole point. Yes.
That's so cool.
Sustainable fashion.
Well, I found somebody who's upset about the look. It is kind of,
but it's my own dang fault, right? You shouldn't ever rely on one platform to.
Yeah, but how much did you? I mean, these were, this was expensive. It was like $100, $200. It was expensive.
Yeah, they were like $200.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am sad.
Yeah.
But I've gotten my use out of it. I will say that.
Yes, you clearly have. The big internet hit of the spring of the COVID crisis was John Krasinski's "Some Good News." It launched like gangbusters, millions of views of every single one of them. He says, I never intended to keep doing it. Posted the first episode on March 30th. 17 million views on that first episode. The virtual prom, 6.3 million views. Apparently, Krasinski never intended to keep doing it. He's too busy being Jack Television's Jack Ryan, I guess. He auctioned it off. And your company bought it, Bill.
Yep. Viacom CBS. CBS did buy it. So, you know, I love Krasinski, so I'll really be interested to see what they do with it.
Well, here's the problem. They bought some good news, but they didn't buy John.
That's we'll have to see what happens with that. You know, they have, you know, there's a lot of really amazing people that do content. And so I'm hopefully they'll come up with, you know, a great plan. But, you know, we'll have to see, you know, and what's interesting to me was sort of the flack, I guess, that John caught for selling this. I thought that was a little bit, you know, I just kind of wondered where that was coming from people. I guess, you know, he struck such a nerve, people kind of hated to see it stop.
Well, you're not allowed, if you're a YouTube success, to quit ever. And and you can only do more videos, never fewer. And apparently John didn't know the rules of the internet. So that's why we're angry.
You're not allowed to have your own life.
How dare you, John? How dare you? Let's see. Oh, and there's one last story, and I think this is a telling of the times. I've been a Pokemon Go fan since July 2016 when it first came out. I've never gone to a Pokemon Go fest. This one I'm going to get to go to because it's virtual. Pokemon Go Fest, July 25th to 26th. You don't have to go to Chicago. You don't have to go anywhere. Just... I don't know what. You just play your game. They've actually done a really good job of making Pokemon Go work better without leaving the house. It's in some ways, it's much more fun. I am so glad you were here, Denise Howell. Thank you so much for being here. Denise is at denisehowell.info, and obviously you must follow her on Instagram, D Howell. That's awesome. It's also
Thank
D Howell
you.
On Twitter.
It's so good to be with you all. It's just so good to connect. And
I love
chat.
You, Denise, and I miss you, and I'm... You're always a part of the Twit family, always.
Love you guys, too.
Yeah. Also, I kind of like Patrick Béja. I'm not going to say I love you, but I do like you a lot. Patrick Béja, FrenchSpin.com. He has English language and French language shows at FrenchSpin.com. Anything?
Yeah, we just launched the...
I was just going to ask you, anything new?
Well, we just launched a show with our good friend Tom Merritt called Work Insanity, which every week gives you a tip and advice, 15 minutes on Mondays, about working from home.
Where is that going to be? On French Spin or where?
Oh, it's just on its own website, just Work Insanity. We launched it last week, so it's very new. Just you can search for that on your podcast app. And
nice.
I love the name, which I came up with, by the way, Work Insanity. Yeah, I think that's very clever.
It's exactly the world we're living in these days. Work Insanity. Well, congratulations. Congratulations to Tom, too, another beloved former Twit family member. So thank you, Patrick. Great to see you. And thank you, Bill Detweiler, a newer member of the family, but always glad having you on, editor-in-chief at Tech Republic. Took Jason Heiner's place. And just great to have you. How are things? Are they calming down a little bit in Louisville? I know it was a little crazy over the last few nights.
We'll have to see. Hopefully, tonight's a little better than it was last night. We do seem to be getting into the actual peaceful protests more so than some of the violent activity we've had. So fingers crossed that continues.
Excellent. Great to have you, Bill. Thank you all for joining me. As I mentioned, we're going to stick around a little extra. We're going to get Baratunde Thurston on the line and talk a little bit about what's been going on. I wanted to kind of keep that as a separate part of the show. But for those of you tuning out, thank you for being here. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon, 2:30 Pacific, 5:30 Eastern. That's 21:30 UTC. You can watch live at twit.tv/live. You can always download shows. We're on YouTube, of course. We're slackers. We only do one tweet a week, but we're on it. We also are on our website. A good place to find us, twit.tv. And if you're on the website, you'll see subscribe buttons. It's the best way to get the show is just subscribe in your favorite podcast application, and that way you'll get it the minute it's available of a Sunday night for your Monday morning commute from your bedroom to the living room. Thank you, everybody, for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Another twit is in the can. Bye-bye. So we're back after a little break. I wanted to really address what's going on in this country, but I didn't know if it fit in with the format of twit. And I also wanted to get somebody on who really could speak to this, a beloved friend we haven't seen in a while, but I know who's somebody whose heart and mind are in this problem, and that's Baratunde Thurston, the author of How to Be Black. I almost feel like you need to write a new book, How to Be White in This World. Where
that is someone else's job, Leo, yeah. But that book should be written.
It needs to be written. It needs
to
be written.
Read and endorse it, assuming it's pretty good. Yeah.
First of all, let me ask how you are.
Thank you for having me on. It's been a while.
It has.
And it's good to hear your voice. I brought my own super serious microphone, so I hope the audience can.
It sounds beautiful.
Understand?
Man.
I was trying to channel my inner Leo, and just add a little extra bass to a voice that's already filled with bass, of course. But so it's good to see you. It's good to be
nice
back,
to
and
see
I
you.
Love your audience as well as you.
They love you. Yep.
And and thanks for asking how I'm doing. I am. Up and down and exhausted and a little excited and a lot nervous. I think this week, you know, the past 7 days have been quite exhausting.
For all of us.
Yes. And so I think it comes on the heels of
exhaustion,
right? Like, you know,
months of exhaustion. Yeah.
If not a marathon, a good 800 meter run, which is like a serious track event for anyone who didn't know that. And then at the end of that race, coach is like, I need you to do the 200 hurdles.
Yeah.
Backwards. Right. Like, so just that's kind of where my energy is. It's kind of low, a little manic,
right.
Worried and somewhat motivated in terms of the hints of good things I'm seeing, but also just like, maybe just not a full predictive commitment to like a great outcome of all this either. Cause we've been through so much of this before.
It is. I mean, what's interesting is that the video of George Floyd's murder, was so vivid and so clear and so unequivocal that even people like Jeanine Pirro on Fox News had to say, this is awful. It's appalling. I'm shocked. Yeah. Even people who would have normally made excuses couldn't look at it and say, oh, well, it was clear.
Yeah.
On the other hand, somebody like a person of color, an African-American, especially an African-American man living in a big city, must have looked at this. And what was your reaction when you first saw it?
Listen, so the way I came to George Floyd's story and his tragic end was actually by way of a woman named Amy Cooper. And so the news junkies amongst your listeners will already know who I'm referring to, but there was an interesting coincidence on one Monday ago where we actually had two racialized policing events happen in the United States. In the morning in Central Park, a black man was bird watching in a section of the park where you're supposed to keep your dog on a leash so they don't trash the bird life. And a white woman, Amy Cooper, was with her dog unleashed. And so the man, coincidentally named Christian Cooper, no relation, calls her out, says, hey, you need to put your dog on a leash. And she's like, nah, I'm not going to do it. Please put your dog on a leash. I'm not going to do it. They go back and forth. He starts offering her dog treats, which he has learned as an avid bird watcher. He's literally like a board member of the New York Audubon Society. If you offer somebody, stranger, dog treats, that owner will bring their dog to heel, put the dog on a leash, because nobody wants strangers feeding their dog. So she gets super offended by this. She's demanding that he stop recording her on the phone, which he had started doing because she was getting super agitated. She goes up, points her finger in his face in a very non-socially distant, as social distance adhering fashion, and threatens him. I'm going to call the police and tell them that an African-American man is threatening my life. Just says it point blank. And he wasn't, but that's what she said she was going to do.
And if you're a black man in America, that's a death threat.
That's a potential death sentence, right? And that has been a theoretical outcome and an actual outcome all too often. I did a whole TED talk just about the phenomenon of white people, largely women, calling the cops on black people for just living their lives. And it doesn't get more life living-ish than bird watching, right? You want to talk about non-threatening person. Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So she offers such clarity. And then she calls and she puts on a bit of a performance for the 911 dispatcher. She claims not only is he trying to threaten her, he's threatening her dog while she is choking the dog on camera. This is all on camera. And then she starts crying a bit. They send the cops immediately. He's African-American. She said it like five times, like it was a slur. African-American man, he's threatening me. He's threatening my life. He's threatening my dog. Send the cops immediately. And that's the video ends with him thanking her. And nothing happened to him other than he got a lot of sympathy from people all across this country because this person abused the power that she has. And the outcome of what she did to him could have been what happened to George Floyd, which happened that very night, also Monday, 1,000 or so miles away in Minneapolis. And we have all seen this snuff film, this assassination tape of... one law enforcement officer persisting and applying pressure to the human neck with his knee to a man lying in a prone position, handcuffs behind his back for 9 minutes, it turns out. 9 minutes. And three other officers doing nothing about it while it's all being filmed, while passersby are saying, stop that, you're going to kill him, while the man himself is saying, I can't breathe, reminiscent of Eric Garner in Staten Island a few years ago, who died of an illegal chokehold implemented by Officer Pantaleo. So it was a Tuesday is when all this stuff was coming out, and Wednesday's when it really landed. And so for me, it was partially, yo, didn't these people see my TED talk? Like I tried to tell you, you know, like I put it in a format. I had the jokes, right? This sort of a ridiculous response. There was anger, a ton of anger. I couldn't have asked for a better lesson for people who refused to listen the thousands of times this has happened before. Well, here it's all laid out pretty cleanly for you. And so often, as you pointed out, Leo, the victims in these circumstances are someone comes up with an excuse for why it was okay for them to be killed. The officer was threatening, you know, feeling threatened. His life was in danger. It was a split second decision. The person was armed. They were running. They were moving.
None of that here.
In the civil rights movement often moved forward and strategically tried to find perfect victims because it knew the conscience of white America would refuse to awaken with anyone less than perfect. And so there were like castings almost to find someone who didn't have any kind of drama in their past, who could be in front of the march, who could be on camera. And that wasn't the case here. It just happened that way. But yeah, it's sad because it's so not new.
Well, I'll tell you what else is sad is post-mortem, it continues because the coroner's report attempted to bring up all sorts of, qualifying conditions, heart condition, diabetes. They even said possible intoxicants, even though there was the medical lab reports aren't out yet and won't be out for some time.
We know my politics are very straightforward and your listeners know that. So it will come as no surprise, my opinion about the president of this country. But I think in this regard, it's potentially universally acceptable what I'm about to say. The president of this country does not behave in a decent way, right? Even if you love his tax plan and you love his stance on immigrants, he is an indecent being. The way he performs, the way he holds the office, the language he uses, the way he uses Twitter, the way he bullies victims. It's just like, it's very hard to look at your child and say, I want you to behave the way the president of the United States. It doesn't matter what his defenders say. It doesn't matter what a pundit says. Even his biggest fans know he does not behave well. And so I think, you know, the coroner's going to have a report. There was some delay in the prosecution. We all saw it. I'm seeing videos of uniformed law enforcement officers saying no. I'm seeing a police chief of Houston march with Black Lives Matter saying no.
I love that.
And it's so rare for police to break ranks with their fraternal organization. So we all know what we saw. I think that there are questions that emerge. What are we going to do? And I think for those who look down on the actions of that officer, look down on the actions of the Amy Coopers of the world who would call that officer to the scene and unleash him on a Black person for forgery or bird watching, neither of which should result in death, then I think there's a question of what to do with the power that this country has granted you. And that's what I've started to look at this week and try to think about for the folks who listen to me.
Right.
A lot is made about white privilege and white supremacy, and that triggers a response in a lot of white people. I don't feel so privileged. I don't feel very powerful. And for those who acknowledge it, I don't want it. It's guilty. I'm that. And you have the whole white guilt thing, and it's very useless to feel guilty about something like that. But here's what's true. This country confers a lot of extra consideration and higher, rated outcomes to white people in this country in so many different areas. And this week made it so starkly clear. So what do you do with that power? And signs of hope that I've seen this week, you use it as a lot of white people did in the protest in Minneapolis to create a line between the police and the Black protesters, because they're less likely to beat up white people, especially on camera.
Mm-hmm.
You use it to send funds to the Minnesota Defense League and all these bailout organizations across the country, because you know who's more likely to get arrested. And you take that hyper responsiveness of the system, and you also look at questioning where that power came from and talking to other white people to start working on this thing. Just like I, as a man, have to talk to other men when I see them acting wrongly toward women, because it's not going to, a woman may not even see that thing going down because the guy will only say it around me. So if not me, there is no check. And so the work of fixing it has to keep shifting to those who are benefiting from it being broken in the first place. And so that's part of how I'm feeling as well, and what I've been thinking about.
Yeah. You said something interesting, that the civil rights movement wanted to activate the conscience of white people. And I think that perhaps that's one of the things, one of the maybe positive things that's happened here. But the problem, I think, for a lot of us is we don't know what to do next.
Right. Yeah.
I'm sure that's a problem for you, too. It's not obvious.
It's not obvious. But here's the good news, especially. This is why I love the Twit audience, Leo. I mean, I've hung out in the IRCs, I have seen the tweets. I've gotten so many people signing up on my mailing list or my text phone number explicitly because of this show. So I know a certain thing to be true, at least about a part of your audience. You're resourceful. This of any crowd, you were on the internet before everybody else, you know how to Google good, right? Not the lazy kind. You know how to do real internet research, not just that front page or the top three or the ad purchase clicks that your aunt and uncle click on. And you can literally read between the lines. So now is a time to use that ability to find good information. I have taken a step and created something as a list of resources to start. There are so many people building lists like these, but on Instagram, which is where I'm kind of digitally living outside of Baratunde.com, my bio link goes to a lot of places. There's books, literally a bookshop that I set up today on bookshop.org, which directs funds to independent booksellers instead of Jeff Bezos, who I think, go out on the limb and say he has enough money. So we've covered Jeff. Right? Jeff's good.
He's good. He's good now.
Jeff's good for a few lifetimes, which I think is about right. And now we can support the independent booksellers of this country. And so there are wonderful books that can help get people up to speed. There are people who do trainings. There's a woman named Rachel Cargill. She's on Patreon. She's on YouTube. She's everywhere we are as TWIT people. And she has live streams and curricula and Q&As and multimodal multimedia. There's an organization which is designed for the white American who wants to do something but just doesn't know what to do. It's called Showing Up for Racial Justice, SURGE. And you can type that into the box. And they've got years in the game of just trying to help folks who want to be helpful but don't know where to start. So there is there aren't many excuses. And I think especially with this community, I know the resourcefulness. So you can get there. It's also a lot of work. And it's a journey. No one's perfect. I'm not perfect. I'm not a perfect human. I'm not a perfect Black person, not a perfect man, not a perfect partner. I'm not aiming for that. I'm just trying to be better. And raising that consciousness is going to take a lot of that type of work. There's people working on the policies. There's all kinds of reforms that we've been reforming. We've been reforming since we started breaking stuff. That's never ending. The consciousness shift is a lot of this softer, more intimate, more personal stuff. And it's going to require people where they are to ask, okay, what can I do? Where am I spending my money? What does my organization look like? Have we ever had a person of color in this position? Have we ever tried? Not that have we rejected anyone who happened to walk through the door. Have we intentionally sought them out? If not, why not? And it's not to beat yourself up and feel like a failure of a woke person. We're all failed woke people. It's a stupid word to begin with. We're all trying to awaken. That's the goal. It's just don't sleepwalk. But as we awaken, let's ask ourselves where we have control, where we have influence, what else can we be doing? And the lists are long, and there's very small actions, and there's very big gestures and a lot in between.
Easiest thing to do, follow Baratunde on Instagram, at Baratunde. His link tree is at linktr.ee/Baratunde. And I am on your text message chain. I love that. It's not a lot of messages, but when they come, I always welcome them. I feel like you're talking to me personally.
I am talking to you personally, Leo.
Am I the only one on it?
No, it's funny. I kind of launched the number, the first number.
Yeah, you changed numbers on me.
Yeah, I've got a new number. It's 202-894-8844. And I've been learning how to use it. So I've got just under 1,000 people, but I don't intimately message with 1,000 people one at a time. Like that's crazy. What I do though, I send out alerts to groups of people based on interest and location. Uh-huh. I solicit input from folks. Here's a real story. Last week when things were popping off in Minnesota, I sent a message just to my texters who live in the Minnesota area, kind of drew a circle around the city, a radius of a certain number of miles, offering just my heartfelt best wishes. It's hard for me, and I live in Los Angeles. I can only imagine when it's literally, your hometown, almost your backyard, some cases your actual backyard. That must be tough. If there's anything you want to share, let me know. And I ended up bringing one person, Minnie wrote back, and I ended up bringing him on my live show on Instagram that night. And he testified to what he had just been through. And it was way more powerful than me punditing, right? People got to hear from someone on the front lines. I send voter registration deadlines. I send silly gifts on your birthday. Like, it's not all serious politics stuff. I do my race thing. I do my tech thing. I do my fun thing all the time. So I'm learning how to connect with people at a certain scale and still be kind of intimate and personal in a way that's a bit different from a broadcast mailing list and certainly from a venue like Twitter, both of which have their value.
It's really cool. Exactly. And I have to confess, when you change numbers, I forgot to follow you. So I just have followed you to the new number.
Welcome back to the fold.
I missed your text.
Yes. Upgraded.
The great thing about having Baratunde in our life and in the TWIT family is that when things like this happen, we can personalize it. the thing that keeps us apart is this, this sense of the other, you know, and all humans do this. If you're not like me, I don't like you. And so it's really important, I think, for us to have people like that aren't like us in our lives, so that when things like this week happen, we understand it and we know it and we love the people that are involved and we care about them. And I care so much about you, Baritone. I'm so glad to
Thank you very much, Leo. I care for you as well. And a little pro tip for the listeners, especially the white listeners who are feeling like you want to reach out to the black person or people in your lives. First, that is a beautiful instinct to express sympathy and how can I help and how are you, et cetera. Also be prepared for people to not want to answer.
Yeah.
Just like anyone kind of in a grieving state, you know, if someone in your family is just dead, you've been through a trauma, you're not necessarily in the mood to process that for your friends. And so use that energy and that desire to help to, you know, find someone who's made themselves available to an author who's written a book. It doesn't take any emotional labor for you to read someone else's book. They've already done that work. It's been banked. So that scales emotionally in a different way. And talking with your own children and your own spouses and coworkers and colleagues about what this is bringing up for you. I think there's a level of intellectual kind of facts and figures and research that is necessary. But I think more important is for all of us to get in touch with how we're feeling and to be real about that. And to talk about that with the people who we feel safe being vulnerable around and work through it on both levels, the emotional level and the sort of intellectual policy, like how do we fix this kind of level? Because it's only when those two come together that we can really move forward in a way that lasts and doesn't kind of feel good for a few weeks or a few months or even a few years or a whole presidency and then roll back.
I feel better already. go to Baritone's World Saving Bookshop and pick up a book. Probably the first one you should start with was How to Be Black. I'm a big fan of Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me. How do you pronounce it?
Ta-Nehisi.
Ta-Nehisi.
Yeah.
This is the most...
This teenager, so I learned how to say his name in the early 90s.
Such a moving book, a National Book Award winner, and... it's required reading, and anything that we can do to help, we should do to help. We owe it to our friends. I'm just glad you could be on with us.
And Leo, if I might, real time edit your statement there, we owe it to ourselves
and ourselves.
I think that it's both. It's both. And I think, again, I always try to like shift the position. Because I do a lot of preaching out and I'm like, am I practicing inside too? And so like, I don't want to end sexism for the ladies, you know, like that's
good. You
know, if the effect is the same, the reasons don't matter as much, but I think the effect will be changed by the reasons that motivate us.
Yeah.
And we've got to want this world to be just for all.
That's all.
We've got to want it for... Yep. The lover that our child might be with, we've got to love it for the boss we might work for or the employee we might hire. We've got to want it for the health. I mean, the exhaustion that we're coming off of and we're still in is a pandemic. Public health. We're all connected, it turns out. And an injury to one is an injury to all. In a really practical sense, it's in the air. We share this air. We share these resources, we share this economy, and we can share this love. So do it for Black people. I won't deny that. Like, yeah, absolutely. Ready for you to jump in the game, but do it for all people too. Do it for humanity. Because when we come together on that, then you're like, okay, climate change, let's do this. Now we got this. Now we got the Avengers lined up, ready to go. It's Infinity War. Let's throw down. We got Black Panther and a Norse god on the same playing field.
Yeah,
let's do this.
That's one thing. Baritone has never shied away from the tough topics. It's so great to see you.
Thank you.
I'm glad you're doing well. Follow him on Instagram, and then in his bio, there's that link to his link tree and a lot of good resources there, a lot of good things we can all do for one another and for ourselves. Yes. Thank you, Barry Attende. God bless, and I hope we see you soon.
Can I just say this? Whether you use it or not, it's been a long time. Another twit is in the can.